Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. We're deep into the library section of everything that comes with Slackware. And that's difficult to talk about sometimes because it's a library. What do you talk about? You give a whole bunch of sample code. I didn't want to do that. I don't want to do that for every library. But the one that is right in front of us right now, APR-1.7.0, is, I think, kind of unique and interesting enough to talk about in a real kind of specific way, or at least it captivated me enough to want to talk about it with some specific code. And so that's what I'm going to do right now. So APR is Apache Portable Runtime, and it originally, at least as I understand it, and I could have some of the details incorrect, but let's be a little bit flexible here. As I understand it, from what I heard around the water cooler, not literal, is that APR was just basically the underlying code of the server, of the Apache server, you know, the HTTP one, the one that built the internet, or that the internet was built upon. So APR was just kind of like the C library for the Apache server. And eventually they broke it out, you know, and made it modular, made it separate from the server, because they kind of got to thinking about it and they realized that it's actually kind of useful to have an Apache licensed libc, essentially. I mean, it's like, it's a C library, Apache license, anyone can run it, and then you have like a sort of a standardized, another standardized C library. And now I'm starting to unsell it, I feel, because now it just sounds kind of arbitrary. But I think there's some value here, because it's a very, again, Apache license. So it's one of those things where people can use it without any kind of obligation. It's very, as they say, permissive. It is just one of those licenses where you can be a horrible person, you can use the code and never give an ounce of your time or consideration back to the developers, and nobody cares because that's the license. So that's an advantage for a lot of companies. Do I care about giving companies an advantage? Not really. In fact, I think they could do with a few disadvantages in this day and age. But I think that there's still value here to APR because it is a library that you could write your program against, and that would be the library that you could then sort of send out with your with your program. So in other words, if you can't rely on what C library a specific system has on it, then you could send this out, you could bundle this with your code, essentially, and trust that there's the C library, a known C library on your target. Does that feel like shipping, I don't know, Python with your Python app? Yeah, a little bit. Does it feel like shipping Java with your Java app? Yeah, sort of. Or it might also feel a little bit like shipping Java and requiring people to have a JVM on their computer in order to run it. So yes, it is. It's one of those things where quite possibly your target audience could already have GNU libc on their machine, or what's the small one, MuSLC or RunC or whatever they are. They have all these other different C libraries on their target. And yet you are shipping APR with your code. Now, don't you feel silly for making people download that entire thing? Maybe you do, maybe you don't. I mean, to be fair, APR itself is all of, at least zipped or XZ'd, it's 255 kilobytes. So, you know, it's not like you're installing a Flatpak and pulling in the whole of the GNOME or free desktop SDK, all 5 gigabytes of it, or whatever it is, 1 gigabyte. It's a small little addition to your source code, but there, you know, once you have it, you have, I guess, a more portable C program than possibly, you know, C built against something else. There are arguments in lots of different directions about that, but that's what APR is. That's the feature that APR offers. And you do see projects using it. There is a page on apache.org about APR, and it talks about who is using their project, and certainly the HTTP server itself is using it. As I say, that's where APR sort of came from. But there's also things like FreeSwitch, Tomcat, Subversion, Apache Subversion, LibreOffice, and a couple of other things like ActiveMQ, for instance, and OpenAMQ. A couple of different projects out there that you may or may not have heard of are using APR, the Apache Portable Runtime. And it's an interesting read to go through some of those projects and look and see how they're using APR. But I took a look at the FreeSwitch code and a couple of other examples online, drummed up a little example to sort of demonstrate what it looks like to use APR. And I'll admit that this isn't a great example for lots of reasons. One of the main ones being that I'm not a C coder. This is about 30 lines of code to do with C, what you could do in, I think, about probably maybe 10 lines of code. And that is just to re-implement a really basic example of the cat command. But so in other words, I'm apologizing for this probably not being the most amazing use of APR, but at the same time, also kind of I want to go through it because it shows some of the different how unique APR can be sometimes when compared to like GNU libc. So hash include APR angle bracket APR underscore general dot h close bracket hash include bracket APR underscore pools dot h close bracket pools again. This is for resource management, and you might kind of. I think that's one of the more interesting components. We'll get into that. Hash include bracket APR underscore file underscore IO dot H close bracket. As you can imagine, that's kind of the APR version of standard IO dot H. Okay, int main parentheses parentheses curly brace. That opens up the one and only function of this very simple C program. First line is APR underscore initialize parentheses parentheses semicolon. That sets up the environment you need for an APR program. It says very specifically in the documentation of APR of the Apache Portable Runtime that any APR program must be the first function call it makes. So you have to do this up front. If you don't do this, things won't work and you'll be frustrated. Believe me, I've tried. So, and not knowingly, it's just I didn't know I had to use APR underscore initialize. Then I learned that you did. So you have to use that up front first. And what that does apparently is it sets up like kind of the infrastructure. It provides argc, it provides argv, it provides, so the arg count and the actual arguments themselves. It, I think, brings in environment variables, or I guess looks at the environment, and apparently it, quote, accounts for, no, that wasn't the quote, it accounts for, quote, platform-specific oddities. I don't know what exactly that means. They gave a couple of examples in the documentation, but it didn't mean a whole lot to me. It was like, such as Win32 services. Well, I don't know what that means, but you call that function and you're good to go. I'm thinking of this in sort of three different sections, and you could even comment what each section is as a reminder. So there's the setup section, and then there's the actual concatenation section, and then there's the cleanup section. We've got the APR initialize parentheses parentheses semicolon. That's a special thing. I mean, I'm going to organize that under the setup stage, but it's, you know, it's super special. First thing has to be that. Okay, next we'll set up a pool for our resources, and then we'll set up a file that we want to read from. So first it's APR underscore pool underscore T. That's the type definition. So space asterisk my pool semicolon. A pool. It is a set of resource that APR knows about. You don't have to worry about what those are so much. You just have to create it. Now we will create it, and it'll be APR underscore pool underscore create parentheses ampersand my pool comma null close parentheses semicolon. That creates the pool. It's set up what a pool is with the type definition, and then it created a pool called my pool. We're going to do the same thing with a file. APR underscore file underscore t space asterisk file semicolon. Well, now we need to create the, or we need to define the file that we need to name the file that we've just made a place for. And that will be char, or C-H-A-R as in character, char space asterisk my file equals quote text.txt close quote semicolon. Before we run this code, we'll create a text.txt file so that that actually means something. In a real program, you would probably not be doing that. You would ask the user, what file do you want? Well, you wouldn't ask. You would allow the user to pass an use an option to pass an argument to your application, which again, the arguments have been, they exist because of APR underscore initialize. But I don't want to get into the whole loop of doing that. So I'm hard coding the file name. Not as exciting as doing dash dash input, you know, that sort of thing, or just a file name, but quicker. Okay, so the next section on line 12, which is just a comment, so /// cat, this is that section, this is the business section of this little application, APR underscore file underscore open parentheses ampersand file, that's the type, comma, my file, that's the actual file, that's the variable we just defined, comma, APR underscore read. That's a macro. It's a C macro. It's all capital. So there's a bunch of code in a header file somewhere that expands APR underscore read to a bunch of stuff that you don't have to do because you're using this. APR underscore read, comma, APR underscore OS underscore default, another macro, comma, my pool. That's our resource pool. Close parentheses, semicolon. Next line is APR underscore off underscore T. So it's another type definition here. And this one is called offset equals zero semicolon. Now, this is really one great reason that I just hate programming in C. There's just this, you have, it's so manual. There's stuff like, you know, in Python, let's say you want to open a file and read it. It's still, to me, I think it's still a little bit ugly. I mean, you have to like open and then you have to do this loop to go through every line or whatever. But I guess that's what programming is, right? But in C, I mean, you have to do APR offset equals zero, and then you do APR underscore file underscore seek. So now we're seeking through the file, parentheses file. So that's again, just the type, not the actual file, comma, APR underscore end, which is a C macro again. So that'll find the end of the file, comma, ampersand offset, parentheses, semicolon. So offset right now is zero. And then we're going to do APR underscore size underscore T space size equals offset semicolon. And so now we know how big the file is. So now we can create a buffer to put all that information from the file into, and then we can read it out of the buffer. So, or we can print from the buffer. So char space asterisk my buffer equals APR underscore PC alloc, that's PCALLOC, parentheses my pool, that's our resources, comma, size plus one, parentheses semicolon. I forget why you need the plus one. Try it without it, you'll see. Offset equals zero, semicolon. APR underscore file underscore seek, parentheses file, comma, APR underscore set, comma, ampersand offset, parentheses semicolon, and then APR underscore file underscore read, parentheses file, comma, buffer, comma, ampersand size, parentheses semicolon. And now we can just use printf, parentheses, my buffer, close parentheses, semicolon. That's the cat section. It's ugly. I hate that section of this code. I mean, it's too bad that it's ugly because that's the main function of this application. I just don't like that. I do not like that style of coding. It's too manual. It's every moment I'm typing that kind of code, I am thinking of all the millions of people around the globe who have typed basically the same thing. I can't stand it. It's exactly like, just put it all in a macro or something. Just give that to me. Like, it's just, it's crazy. I understand that it's, you know, that kind of flexibility is exactly what enables like a bunch of other stuff, but just something like this, I don't know, it just annoys me. Anyway, that's the cat section. This is the final section, cleanup. /// cleanup to make a comment. Next line, so that's line 23 we're on, if you're counting. APR underscore file underscore close parentheses my file, close parentheses, close semicolon, APR underscore pool underscore destroy parentheses my pool close parentheses semicolon, and then APR underscore terminate parentheses semicolon, and then return zero semicolon. Curly brace. Sorry, not my file. File. APR underscore file underscore close file. Not my file. That's it. That's the application. But we need now some text file in the same directory for convenience. So I'm going to create Emacs space text.txt because that's what I said in the thing. And I'll type hello, and then another line GNU, then another line world, another line of, another line open space source. That way we have two words on one of those lines. I got a little bit carried away with the lines there. And now we should be good to go, sort of. And when I say sort of, I mean, because we're not using the standard library of C, we're using APR. So if I just do a GCC, what did I call this? mycat.c, then I get an error right away. It says fatal error, APR general.h, no such file or directory, include APR underscore general.h. Now you can solve that in two different ways. You can go into the code and do an include of angle bracket slash user include slash APR dash one or whatever it is, and so on. Or you can leave it generic, just the file name, and then in your compiling instruction, specify where it needs to look for those includes. That is more portable, because if you hard code it into the thing, then everyone will have to keep their APR libraries in slash user slash include slash APR dash one. What if someone doesn't have a user include? Like, what if someone is compiling in their home directory? So we're going to do it, you know, the right way and do it in GCC. So GCC dash capital I, or space dash capital I, no space slash USR slash include slash APR dash one. How do I know that? Well, if I go to do a more slash var log packages on slash APR dash 1.7.0 and look through the included files that Pat Volkerding put on the install disk, it looks like the path is user include APR dash one. And then inside of that are all the header files, APR.h, APR underscore allocator, APR scan through, APR underscore file underscore io.h, APR underscore general.h. Those are the ones that we need. They're APR underscore pools.h. Those are the exact ones that we need, and that's where they are located. Okay, so we're still doing GCC. That's the dash, so dash capital I underscore slash USR slash include slash APR dash one, then space dash lowercase l dash l APR dash one. So it looks like dash lapper dash one. It's really weird. But that's how you, again, that's the notation for GCC. You don't need to give the full path of the library. You just need to tell it where that library lives. How do we know where that library lives? Once again, you go to var log packages. You look at what got installed. Where's the library here? There should be something called libapr. And yep, here it is. usr/lib64/libapr-1.so.0.7.0. So that's where that lives, libapr. Luckily, GCC already knows about user lib64 as part of its configuration for our system, but we still need to tell it which library in that directory we want to use. And the library that we want to use is APR-1. And then finally, we can give it the name of the file that we want to compile, which is mycat.c in this case. And I'll just go ahead and do a dash O mycat. That way it gets a nice name on the when it's compiled down. Press return, and it's compiled because it's a very little, tiny little program. And now we can execute it with ./mycat. And we don't need to give it the text name because that's hard-coded. So it's just going to spit out, hello, GNU world of open source. And there you go. That's APR. So the things to remember are, if you're using APR, you're using APR as, well, you don't, so I should say, you don't have to just use APR. FreeSwitch, if I recall correctly, yeah, I'm almost positive, FreeSwitch used APR in addition to another C library. Could be remembering that incorrectly, but you can do that. Like, you can use APR, and then also use standard IO or whatever. So that's not a problem. It'll work. But if you're using APR, then you need to point your compiler to where you have your APR header files and your APR library so that it can include and compile against those things. Also, if you're using APR, things are different. You're not just swapping out fopen for APR underscore file underscore open. It's different. Like, the arguments are going to be different. The process that you go through to do something is going to be different. So in other words, it's not like a drop-in replacement for GNU libc. It's a different thing. It's its own thing. And you have to adjust. I mean, it's a little bit weird sometimes, or it's a lot bit weird sometimes. So that's just something to be aware of. It is not, here's GNU libc with a, you know, but instead of coloring it blue, we've colored it red. It's a completely different thing, except that you can write C code, but those functions that you're calling, those are unique things. I mean, I think the first line is a dead giveaway, APR underscore initialize. You'd never think to do that I don't think you would think to do that with any other C library. I could be mistaken, but I mean, certainly with libc you wouldn't do it, and I don't think you would do it with those, you know, those other minimal, you know, what is it, run c or something, or musl c or whatever those other ones are. I don't recall ever seeing anything about that in those libraries. I mean, I haven't looked in a while, but yeah, it's very unique. It's a different sort of, it's its own thing. Keep that in mind. And that is APR. That's the Apache Portable Runtime. Such an interesting concept, I think. The next package after that is APR util, which is a additional utility interface for APR, including support for XML, LDAP, database interfaces, URI parsing, and so on. So remember in the concatenation section how I was complaining a lot about how horrible it is to have to do all of these things manually, because you know that millions of other people have done all of those things already, and it just feels so wasteful to do it. Well, APR-util frees you from a lot of that stuff. You're still writing C code. So, you know, you've signed up for that, right? If you're doing that, you've signed up for a certain amount of legwork. But with APR-util, you get a bunch of functions that kind of help you deal with that differently. So you've got, for instance, APR underscore base 64. That seems useful. APR underscore crypto. APR underscore LDAP. I mean, that's got to be huge. APR underscore Redis. APR underscore SHA-1, APR underscore URI, as they were saying, APR underscore XML. So lots of things that you can imagine. Oh, date, APR underscore date. So a lot of things that you can imagine would just save you a lot of time and effort to probably like reverse engineer and figure out on your own. Well, it's just right there. So you don't have to think too hard about it. You can just use one of the utility libraries instead. Speaking of letting other libraries do the hard work for you, the next one in the list here is Argon 2. And Argon 2 is it's a library to help you hash passwords. This is specifically a C implementation of the Argon 2, I guess, algorithm. It is it's based on a password hashing function that won the password hashing competition. That's PHC. And in fact, its Git repository is simply called PHC-winners-argon2. So it's really leaning into that password hashing competition, which is, sounds fascinating, by the way. I'm not belittling it for being proud of having won the password hashing competition. It's very cool. I'm just saying that's very, very much like, this is it. This is the winner of probably something with a lot of competition. Like, I can I I would imagine you wouldn't enter the password hashing competition unless you were pretty confident in your cryptography. So Argon2, the library included with Slackware has both the reference application as well as the header file so that you could write your own application, or rather use the algorithm in your own application, I guess, really. So, and it is just one header file, argon2.h. Find it in your user include. But the password application itself reads from standard in, so you'll probably do something like echo password 123 pipe argon2, and then assault some thing to adjust the way the password is encrypted. So I'll put GNU world order, and that provides me with the hash of that password. Now, if I do, for instance, echo password 123 pipe argon2 Fedora Linux, then as you would hope, the hash is different. It isn't literally this, but I'll compare it to, for instance, a Caesar cipher. So I don't know if you know what a Caesar cipher is, but apparently back in, you know, like the Roman times and stuff, Caesar himself, the great Caesar himself, invented cryptography, or a system of cryptography in which you take a letter and shift it over some number of other letters in the alphabet. So if you do an echo A pipe Caesar 1, then you get B. If you do a Caesar 2 on that, you get C. If you do a Caesar 25 on that, you get Z, because there are 26 letters. You're starting at 1, going all the way to the end. That's a Caesar cipher. So again, not a literal thing, but the salt functionally, or I guess you could almost say that, well, no. But anyway, the salt functionally uses it's the same purpose, right? It's a little bit of randomness. Or you know what? I guess the salt would be something whereby you, well, who cares? I'm overthinking it. The point is that the salt changes the way the encryption works. And if you know what the salt was, then you know the special parameters required to decrypt the thing. If you don't know what the salt is, then you may know the method of undoing the encrypted data, but you don't know how far to go. So in other words, if I said echo A Caesar something, then what are we going to get? Or conversely, if I said I ended up with the letter X, what did I start with? Well, unless you know Caesar some integer, you don't know. You could guess. You could say, well, X, you were doing a lot of stuff with A earlier, so maybe you started with an A, meaning that the Caesar cipher would have been like, what would that be, like 23? So maybe the answer is 23 offset, but you don't know that. And if it's a big long string like argon2, of course, then it would even be, as you can imagine, more difficult, because now you're looking at something like password 123 with salt of Fedora Linux. And it's not just a one for one letter translation. It's, you know, the hash of that is 6BD400A1A3225BD1AO46F30, you know, and it just goes on and on. So that's fun stuff. I wish I knew more about cryptography. That's it, though. That's argon2, the command, and argon2.h, the header file, lets you do all that stuff except in C functions. Time for coffee. All right, we're back with coffee. Time to continue our tour. Look up there, right over there, beyond the coffee tree. Yes, it is Aspel. Aspel is one of my favorite applications in the world, believe it or not. I love Aspel, or maybe not. It might be iSpell. Let's read. GNU Aspel is a spell checker designed to eventually replace iSpell. I'll bet you anything that's been the official line of Aspel since 1997. I just get it. I get that feeling, because anytime you see eventually replace, you know, like especially in software, I feel. It just means both things will continue to exist forever. Anyway, it can either be used as a library or as an independent spell checker. And yeah, it's true. A spell can be used as an independent spell checker. It can also be used within Emacs. So lots of different options, and I'll step you through some of them right now. So Emacs text.txt, that's the file that we used for the MyCat application. I'm going to repurpose it here. I'm going to write, I'll just delete everything that was there and just write, hello, GNU World Arder, A-R-D-E-R, of WPEN source. So lots of misspellings there. Realization with an S, not a Z, and then a word that's complete nonsense, just random letters. And then I'm going to make another paragraph and do a paragraph tag for docbook para. This is a paragraph, and then close the paragraph tag. And that's probably good enough for a demo. Okay, so now I'm going to do a spell in the terminal, a spell dash C for check text.txt. It takes over your terminal. It becomes its own little interface, and it flags the first thing, hello, GNU World Arder, A-R-D-E-R instead of order. So it gives me a choice down at the bottom of the terminal of words that it might think that was supposed to be. So one is adder, two is ardor, like ardor. Three is order. So I'm going to type in three, and it replaces it and moves on to the next misspelling, which is WPEN, which should be open. Does it get open at all? Yeah, it does. After 9 guesses, it figures out that it might be open. So I'm going to click, I'm going to press 9. And then source, it gets that on the first go. So one, realization with an S instead of a Z. It does believe that that's incorrect, even though I have my system set to NZ localization. So I'm not sure why it picked that up. Realization with a Z. I guess I'll go that way. And then there's that nonsense word, W-A-U-Q-H-T-A-Z. It has no idea what that is, so I'm going to just do an R, lowercase r, for replace, and replace it with Warhammer. And that was it. That was all the misspellings. So it didn't pick up the para tags, which is awfully nice and not what I had expected. And I guess there were no other misspellings than that. Okay, so I'm going to go back. Oh, I can't because everything's spelled correctly. It refuses to check something that's all correct. It just, I mean, presumably it checks it, but it doesn't say, you know, it doesn't tell you. It just silently continues. All right, so I'm going to change some things in this file. I'm going to change that realization back to an S. And now I'm going to do aspell-c text.txt again. And yeah, it's flagging realization because I put it back to an S. So there's other options too. There's I to ignore, and there's A to add. This is highly, highly confusing, by the way, because in Emacs, I'm pretty darn sure it's the exact opposite. I believe A is accept and I is insert. So if you want a word to be remembered in your personal dictionary, in Emacs, you press I to insert it into your dictionary, or you press A to accept it for this session. Just stop telling me it's misspelled during this spell check. And here it's the exact opposite. It's A to add it to your dictionary, or I to stop telling me that it's incorrect. So I guess I'll hit I to ignore that word. And then it does find program listing in brackets. So para, I guess, was just, I guess, enough of a word to not be flagged. But it does, I changed my XML tag to program listing, all one word, and it sees that as an error. In this context, it's not. It's a docbook tag. So I could add it, or I could ignore it, or I could just hit apparently B for abort. So lots of different options there. So that's a spell. It's also apparently a library. And like I say, I'm pretty darn sure that that's what I'm using in Emacs. But hold on, let me check. I'm going to actually look in my thing. It might be that I'm using iSpell. No, yeah, I am using aSpell. So set q iSpell-program-name space quote aSpell close quote. So interestingly, I am using aSpell. And yeah, I'm pretty darn sure it's the exact opposite in Emacs. That's really weird. I never really noticed that before. To be fair, I usually use aSpell from within Emacs. I don't often use it the way that I just demonstrated here in the terminal. But it is a good thing to know about, obviously, because if you need a spell checker on a text file, just run it through Aspell. Well, Aspell-C, that always confuses me. It feels like you should just be able to do Aspell file name, but you have to do the -C for check. Next up is Aspell-EN. That's the English dictionary files for Aspell. I could probably find an Aspell-UK to get it to stop bugging me about New Zealand spelling. I will say, by the way, it is weird being someone who grew up with American spelling, and then you're living in a place where that's not the correct spelling. And, you know, I mean, no one's checking my work, really, so I can do whatever I want. But my computer localization is set to New Zealand, so it thinks that the local spelling is the correct spelling. And I don't mind the local spelling. I'll adopt that as the correct spelling. I like it. So I'll do that. And then at work, I work with mostly Americans, so and for an American company. So in that sense, it's a global company, but its audience, you know, it uses American spelling is what I'm saying. So that's the correct spelling there. It's very confusing. I don't know what to set my computer to or my brain to. And then last, I think, for this episode, but certainly not least, and in fact, this is why it's last, because I think it's probably going to inspire a bit of a talking point. It's the AT-SPI2-ATK. -ATK. I think that's what I said. Which bridges the AT-SPI2 what is it? Interface to ATK. That's just a mouthful, and that's okay. It is something that we can reverse engineer. So there is this is a GNOME library, but it's not specific to GNOME. So if you go to its Git repository, you'll find that a lot of information. So first of all, ATK is the Accessibility Toolkit, which is a set of G object interfaces that can be implemented to communicate with assistive technologies, otherwise often known as AT or ATs if you're doing it plural. SPI2 is the assistive technology, that's AT, Service Provider Interface, SPI. And this is the second edition of that. So GTK3 calls ATK directly and assumes that AT-SPI2-ATK is there. GTK2 loads a module at runtime to do basically the same thing. Chromium uses this, GNOME Shell uses it. Anything that uses ATK directly, like Mozilla Firefox, it ends up needing AT-SPI2-ATK. So that's the information about sort of the concept. You can find out even more about it at gitlab.gnome.org/gnome/AT-SPI2-ATK. But there is, I mean, obviously it's not just GNOME. Other things are using this. And there's a lot of information, to be honest, or a fair amount of information, to be honest, about this kind of stuff, both on GNOME and KDE websites. So if you go to like community.kde.org/accessibility, it's a non-trivial amount of information. I mean, a lot of it's pointers to other places, but there's technical information about, you know, accessibility and software. And in the KDE division, which is what I'll focus on just because GNOME doesn't ship with Slackware, so it seems weird. I mean, people can run GNOME on Slackware, but it doesn't ship with it. So I'll focus on KDE in this case. And so the accessibility applications in KDE are, if you go to the site that KDE itself directs you to from the accessibility, there are three. There's KMag, which is a screen magnifier. There's KMouse Tool, which is an automatic mouse clicker. And there's KMouth, which is a speech synthesizer front end. Although, don't let that fool you, the voice that KMouth uses is really pretty rough. And I would say I would say maybe a little disappointing. I should do a show about sort of that sometime, but I frankly need to study up on it more. There are some really great voices out there in open source, but I guess you really have to configure it. You really have to set that up. Either way, those are the three quote-unquote accessibility tools in KDE. And that doesn't really cover everything, to be honest, but those are applications that sort of consider themselves, I guess, mostly or primarily tools for accessibility. And that's great, because KMag, I mean, it'll magnify a screen. And if you can't see your screen clearly when it's at normal size, then maybe you can see it better once it's larger, depending on what you need. KMouse tool could be good for mobility stuff. Mobility. KMouth could be good for people who can't see at all. So really important applications, really important functionality. And if you go to the technical information for application developers, there's the KDE Human Interface Guidelines, which attempts to assist people designing the applications on sort of how to kind of optimize your application for accessibility. And it's tough, right? Because the reason is because accessibility is a really, really broad term, and it is also a very, very diverse term. So by broad, I mean, is something accessible? What does that mean? Does it mean when a user new to Linux sits down at the computer, do they feel comfortable with that application? Is it accessible? Sure, that's what it could mean. It could also mean when someone who is blind sits down at your computer, can they use it at all? Can someone install your operating system? Is that accessible? Can someone who has no motion control, but maybe, moving something with their eye or like eye movement or subtle movements of their head or something, can they use the computer? Lots of different sort of, can someone who cannot hear, someone who is deaf, can they use a computer and get meaningful alerts when they need to have their attention drawn to something rather than a chime that they can't hear? These are all totally valid, like, interpretations of the word accessible. And so when you're a developer and you're thinking, how do I make my software accessible? I mean, that's not a meaningful statement almost, you know, because it's like, well, who are you trying to make it accessible to? And I think more than thinking about like, what do I need? What do we need as an open source community? What do we need to do to make things accessible? I really think, and go with me on this for a minute, I think what we need to be doing is asking, how can we make the software that we write flexible? Because that's really what matters to people, like for accessibility. Like, you need to be able to set things up on your computer the way that it works best for you. And some desktops, I'm not going to name any desktops specifically, we're not here to point fingers, but some desktops, and it's not KDE, seem to be moving or have moved towards a very sort of firm, like, this is our desktop, this is how it works, this is what it looks like, while other desktops remain quite flexible. And I'm not by any means saying that KDE is more flexible than GNOME. Oh, did I just name the desktop that I was trying not to name? Anyway, I'm not saying one is more flexible than the other. I'm just saying that KDE has a lot of options to it. And now, again, accessibility is a big, broad term. So to some people, they might say, well, that makes KDE inaccessible to people who get overwhelmed by too many options. And I think that's a valid concern. And I think there's a world where you could maybe turn off the options. You know, you could just be, give me the simplified view. That could be a thing. And KDE actually had such a thing for a little while. I don't remember what it was called. It was something like kiosk mode. That may have been what it was called. And it was a Plasma desktop setup where it was, I think, like, it had buttons in the middle of the screen, kind of like a mobile phone almost. That was your launcher, your application launcher. And I think you could even set which ones were there by default. You know, you had, like, your browser, your file manager, and probably a network setting thing or something like that, or preferences. And that was it. Like, that was the interface. And it was a crazy idea. And I mean, certainly I never used it, but I checked it out just for fun. And yeah, it was like really, it was like, oh my gosh, like this is the worst thing I've ever seen, and the perfect thing for the mythical grandmother that we're always all worried about having to use. You know, how can we get this mythical grandmother or grandfather to to use Linux. Well, you hand them this 3-button laptop and maybe it'll work. So I think the key really is to make things flexible, because if you've got a function on your desktop that can invert the screen on demand, or that can magnify the screen, or that can get rid of all the funky little tiny buttons up in the top right, because all I really ever use that for is network settings, and the other ones just overwhelm me, or they, because I can't see which icon is which, it just absolutely makes it unusable for me. Or maybe you don't want them up at the top right screen at all. Maybe you want them over on the left-hand side. Well, you can do all of that stuff in KDE really, really easily. And I think that's a huge advantage to KDE. I think the flexibility of a platform is a huge accessibility feature for all the different kinds of accessibility requirements. I'm not saying KDE has all the accessibility stuff down exactly perfectly. I don't think that it does. And I don't think computing does, and I don't think open source does. I think open source, you know, in spirit should be at the cutting edge, right? We should have the best stuff, because we are the operating system and the software for the people. Like everyone is welcome here, right? So obviously we would have the stuff that would let them use the platform. And yet every blind person I know has an iPhone, because the accessibility features on an iPhone are second to none. I mean, you can use an iPhone without sight, and it's crazy how you do it. I mean, it's like you hold down a finger on the thing, and then like if you're dialing a number, the numbers reorient essentially wherever you touch, basically. So from where you first press, the numbers now are oriented around that, something like that. I've never done it, so I don't know. But I mean, literally, I have people who are blind who use iPhones. Like it's a thing that they can do 100%. Like the accessibility is that good. And you just look at, like, I don't know, Android, and that's not quite as good. I don't know, but I mean, I haven't met any blind person using Android. I'm sure someone is, but it doesn't seem to be as common as iPhone use with blind users. So I don't know. So in spirit, I think open source should have the best. But I think in practice, you know, we're stuck with these really, really awkward sounding text to speech voices, unless you install a bunch of other stuff and tie them together. We're stuck with a somewhat open source phone OS that doesn't really, you know, I guess it'll take voice commands, you know, which is awkward if you don't want to speak to your phone somewhere. Maybe you don't want to do that. You just want to use your phone. You don't want to have to shout at your phone. We have operating systems that you might not be able to install under certain conditions, or you know, without a certain condition. Slackware, of course, does this quite well. I mean, it's got the speech synthesizer stuff built into the kernel from the start, the speak up. So I mean, you can install Slackware under a lot of different conditions, but I mean, you might not be able to. So my point is that the more that we aim to just make software flexible, not necessarily just because, oh, someone might not have sight, or someone might not be able to hear that thing, or someone might not be able to move their mouse from here to there. It's also just because someone might arbitrarily not want that thing. And that's the thing about accessibility, that, you know, everyone benefits from the weirdest accessibility features. I mean, really, I feel like I've had an example of that once a week for the past 5 years, you know, just where you see something and you think, oh my gosh, that's so darned useful. And then you think, I wonder if that feature is because of this reason. But for you, as someone who's maybe not disabled in a drastic way, it's just a really cool feature. It's just a really nice thing to have. But some people, like, really, really need that feature. So I think all of the features in the software that we use, I think every feature that we have in software is potentially an accessibility feature. And more we make it easy, the more and more we're inviting more people over to open source. I think in spirit, we all kind of know and agree with that. I mean, I hope. And certainly anyone, you know, like if we just sit around and say, oh, we should be better at accessibility in open source, I mean, that's not going to fix anything. So it's like a quote, important unquote topic. And yet it's also, I think it's just, it feels like a topic that, yes, we should make things more accessible. But I think the missing component for me at least is that accessibility, quote unquote, accessibility, it's not a magical switch that you have to just make sure that you flip in your code. It's not like it's not just a little library that you include. I mean, it can literally be a library that you include, at-spi2-atk, for instance, but it can also be keeping software flexible because sometimes you can't anticipate a particular accessibility need. You just won't think of it. It just won't occur to you because you've made it accessible for a blind person, you've made it accessible for a deaf person, you've made it accessible for someone with mobility problems. But what about the person with color blindness? Or what about the person with a depth perception issue? I don't know why you'd need, that probably wouldn't matter on a 2D screen, huh? But anyway, you know, like there's always something else that you just may not think about. There might not even be a library for that thing because you're not, maybe it's not part of the interface. Maybe it's, or it is part of the interface, but it's not part of the code. It's just part of the design. Again, like the color blindness being a quick and easy example. You might think that two things are perfectly distinguishable from one another because you've followed all the rules on contrast and on, you know, making sure that everything's looks different and can be seen in varying contrast situations, and you followed all the mobility rules and everything like, but the thing that you forgot was that some people just don't see the color at all, and so you really need to give it like a different, you know, you need to give it stripes and dots or something like that instead of just the different colors, whatever the case might be. There's always something out there, and the more flexible and malleable we make it for the user, the less we give users the opportunity to be frustrated by what we're giving them. That's where I'm going to end this episode. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next week.